Yeah, I'm Okay, this is history. Good morning. And I think today we should finish this period of church history, which is 590 to 1517. Pardon me? Oh, yes. Let's see. Which one is that? I'd have to look it up myself in the front of my book. Okay. Catholic terms. Assignment is due. Why don't you pass those in? Now, I announced your test on 590-1517, didn't I? Yeah. Did I say it's Wednesday when we get back, which should be the 25th? Okay. Today, we want to talk about Erasmus. Yes.
Those definitions, you know,
mm-hmm.
They made me sick.
They did?
Amen.
They were sick.
It was awful.
Bondage.
Yep. Let's see. Anathema, that's a Bible word. That means to be cursed by God in the Greek. Bulls, that's not a Bible word. Decretal, excommunication is a Bible doctrine. Indulgence, that's not, is it? Interdict, that isn't. Mass, that isn't. Sacrament, that isn't. Suspension, that's not a Bible word, but, you know, I think the church government at times, if it needed to impose some punishment on somebody, would have that right by God. Okay, we're studying 590 to 1517. The last pre-Reformation character we want to look at is Erasmus. That's 1466 to 1536. So you'll see he overlaps with Martin Luther, whose date is 1517. Desiderius Erasmus. He's a Dutch scholar and humanist from Rotterdam in Holland, which is what we call the Netherlands today. It's right here on the map, just north of France and Belgium. Now, he was born out of wedlock. His father was a priest. This is typical of the immorality of the day. And his parents died when he was 13. I told you that he wasted certain years in school and was forced to enter the convent against his will. And he did and became a Catholic priest, but he hated it. He never ministered as a priest. Instead, the Catholic Church sent him to the University of Paris, where he studied literature with all of his energy and developed a great reputation for learning. He was invited to England by Lord Mountjoy in 1498, where he became acquainted with eminent men, received many honors, and was offered the position of teaching Greek. He held the theological chair at Cambridge University as professor of New Testament Greek, and he was without rival in the world in his day, the most educated man. He wrote, he traveled, he received an honorary doctor's degree, and he bent all of his efforts on producing a Greek New Testament. This had never been done since the original New Testament was written. No one had taken all of the fragmentary manuscripts and collated them together into a complete testament from Matthew 1:1 to Revelation 22:21. And so he made what we call a Greek text. A text is a collation of ancient manuscripts. A manuscript is defined as an ancient copy of a document, ancient handwritten copy of a document. And he collated these fragmentary manuscripts into a complete New Testament Bible in Greek. He completed it in 1516. We say that's 1 year before the Reformation. And his Greek text had a critical apparatus with it. That's which gave different readings and what manuscripts supported which readings. It also had a Latin translation in the margin. And some of his renderings were different than the Latin Vulgate. Now this is very dangerous in his day to deviate from the Holy Catholic Bible called the Latin Vulgate. There were many outcries. They said, why should the language of the schismatic Greeks interfere with a sacred traditional Latin? You see, they're going by the fact that the church at Corinth was carnal, you know, because the Bible talks about how carnal they are. One other one wrote this, quote, how could you improve on the Vulgate, close quote. Well, no translation is perfect. Every translation can be improved upon. Cambridge Theological College did not accept his text. It was unauthorized, and he couldn't use it there at the university. Pope Leo, though, accepted it. The reason he accepted it is Erasmus was smart. I've told you, he's the smartest man in the world. He dedicated the text to the Pope. And so at the beginning it says, dedicated to His Majesty, His Holiness, and therefore he accepted it. And he sheltered him. Erasmus was held in esteem by everyone, including the Pope. All Catholic prelates around the world liked him. Princes, princesses, kings, queens. He was friends with the aristocratic people of his day. Erasmus' Greek text, though, was produced before there were very many manuscripts available. His oldest manuscript dates from the 12th century. And so he didn't. This text is very inadequate when you compare it to, you know, the type of ones that we have today. His first edition was kind of rushed. And the reason is there was another cardinal in Spain named Ximenes. And Cardinal Ximenes, I believe that's spelled X-I...
I'd have to write it because I don't have it written down in my notes.
It's spelled X-I-M-I-N-E-S. Cardinal Ximenes in Spain, had actually produced a Greek text before Erasmus. I can't remember right now, but I think he finished it in 1514. And it was done. But because of papal red tape, he couldn't publish it. And so Erasmus finished his as fast as he could and got it printed and circulated, and therefore he's given credit for the first Greek New Testament. Although technically this other Roman Catholic cardinal did it first. At any rate, it had many typographical errors in it too, because printing was a new art and he was so rushed. Later editions were better. The only edition of his that uses 1 John 5:7 is his third edition. Most of you have heard the story of that. He was criticized because the Latin Vulgate had 1 John 5:7 in it, and his Greek New Testament left it out. When asked why, he claimed that if anyone could show him a Greek manuscript that had it in it, he would put it in it. This is after his second edition. Dr. Beagle, Dewey Beagle, you ever heard of him? B-E-E-G-L-E. He wrote a book called God's Word into English. And in his book, he claims that the Catholic Church wrote a Greek New Testament just for Erasmus, which had 1 John 5:7 in it, and they brought it to him. The date of this manuscript is right from the time of his third edition. It's apparently a newly copied manuscript, and it had it in it. And being a man of his word and of some reputation, you know, and we could say, and the demon of legalism, you know, because he claimed that he would do it, and therefore he would do it. He did it. He put it in his third edition. But apparently he knew that it was a forgery, and so he left it out of all subsequent editions. He took it right back out, and it's not in 4, 5, 6, 7, or 8. The King James Bible comes from what we call the Textus Receptus. And the Textus Receptus is just a name for the form of Greek text Erasmus used. There's a lot of information that has to do with, you know, the intricacies of how this happened. And people copied Erasmus, and then people copied those people. And there are several different Greek editors or Greek text makers whose texts are called the Textus Receptus. And I don't have my notes in front of me, and I can't remember exactly how it all works, but there are a number of them in order, and I think what happened is there were brothers called the Elzevir brothers, and then there's this man named Robert Stephanus, or Robert Estienne, he's called, commonly called Stephanus, and it goes something like this. The Elzevir brothers used Erasmus' third edition to produce their text, and Stephanus used the Elzevir brothers to produce their text, and the King James Bible was translated from this one. It's something like that. I don't remember for sure, but at any rate, the King James Bible ultimately goes back to Erasmus' third edition, and that's why the King James Bible has 1 John 5:7 in it. If they would have used a different edition of Erasmus, the King James Bible would not have that verse in it. Printing houses clamored for his New Testament. They also printed his letters and published them through all of Europe. Cardinals coaxed him with promises. Kings tried to persuade him to come live in their court and be an advisor. He was appointed a chancellor, for example, to the Prince of Burgundy, which is an area in France, but he never went there. The King of France urged him to come live in the palace and be an advisor. Never did that either. He became a national hero in France and in the Netherlands and in England. He's the most well-known man around the whole world. He turned down lots of tempting offers for money and promotion and pensions to support him for the rest of his life if he would just come live in their country and just study and write, and they'd support him with a rich lifestyle. His Greek New Testament, though, resulted in many new translations of God's Word because people could take the Greek and then translate it into the language of their nation. Tyndale, for example, studied Greek under Erasmus. And, of course, you're familiar with Tyndale's translation. It's one of the early English Bible translations. He worked for 6 years, 1515 to 1521, to secure a complete release from his monastic vow. He took vow of poverty, you know, I was going to say poverty, disease, and ignorance, but not really. Poverty and you know, chastity and these other vows that the monks take, and he got released from them. Everyone was doing homage to him, including Martin Luther. He was a friend of Martin Luther, although later in their life they broke with each other. He also had a friendship with the very learned Mr. Thomas More in England, an English humanist. More led him into a humanistic brand of Christianity, though. Erasmus especially liked the church fathers who spiritualized the Bible. They follow the allegorical method. Erasmus is a Catholic. The Catholics follow that method. They don't interpret literally. He wasn't really a rigid Bible scholar. He was more a scholar of literature and an expert in it. His most famous book is called Praise of Folly. Praise of Folly was circulated through all Europe and Britain in his own lifetime. But it was printed anonymously so that he could deny the authorship if he needed to. Now, the reason is, it was a biting satire against the Roman Catholic Church, but it's brilliant. And it destroys myths and corruption, and it attacks the authority of the papacy and his wild, extravagant lifestyle. And what he's doing is he's praising how all the folly of the system. And by saying how good it is to be this way, everybody knows he means how bad it is to be that way, see? And the whole book is like that. Erasmus is one of these people who lived 200 or 300 or 400 years before his time. He's an anachronism in history. He's out of time sync. He's like a modern Baptist preacher who's anti-Catholic, going back and living in 1500 and attacking the Catholic Church. The strange thing is, he never left the Catholic Church. He remained a Catholic for life. He's viewed as a member of the pre-Reformation movement by most historians, except Catholic ones, because they claim him still. And so Protestants claim him, and Catholics claim him, kind of like the Apostle Paul. You know how the Baptist Church claims Paul? The Catholic Church claims Paul, even named city St. Paul. And the Pentecostal Church claims St. Paul. We all fellowship with Paul, even if we won't fellowship with each other. But that's the way this guy is, kind of. He's strange. He fits in a middle ground. He's very anti-Catholic in certain ways, and he's pro-Catholic in other ways. He's a reformer, but he remained a Catholic. He attacked the church, and yet he praised the church in certain ways. He thought Martin Luther was excessive to make a break with the Catholic Church and leave it and start his own church. He disagreed with that type of thinking. He stayed in the church and secretly helped the Reformation, although later he attacked parts of the Reformation. Now, I want to do just a little bit of reading for maybe 5 minutes from this book, Praise of Folly, so you get an idea of the kind of writer he is. Now remember, in the day he lived, books are rare. People don't own books like you and I do. They cost too much. And so people would hand copy little sections of it and pass it around. And they did print it, and some people owned books, I'm sure. But anything written was just devoured by everyone. And so they tried to circulate it and make it as cheap as possible. And so people loved this book. And everybody knew that Erasmus wrote it. But he wouldn't admit it. Okay, quote, just picking some sections. See here. Those who are closest to these in happiness are generally called monks or religious, and both of these are deceiving names, since for the most part they stay as far away from religion as possible, and they frequent every sort of place. You see, he's writing about these monks. Now, the average guy saw the monk every day, and they knew the guy was corrupt. You know, they see him in the tavern, or they see him with a prostitute, or they see him that the guy is corrupt, but he's claiming to be the Holy Father, and they have to go to him for confession and everything anyway. So he's going to expose what these guys are really like, and they're all going to laugh and think it's real funny, because nobody dares says anything against him except this guy. I cannot, however, see how any life could be more gloomy than the life of these monks, if I did not assist them in many ways. Though most people detest these men so much that accidentally meeting one is considered bad luck, the monks themselves believe they are magnificent creatures. One of their chief beliefs is that to be illiterate is to be of a high state of sanctity, so they make sure they are not able to read. Another is, when braying out their gospels in church, they are making themselves very pleasing and satisfying to God, when in fact they are uttering these psalms as a matter of repetition instead of from their heart. Indeed, some of these men make a good living through their uncleanness and beggary by bellowing their petitions for food from door to door. There is not an inn, an announcement board, or a ship into which they are not accessible, here having a great advantage over other common beggars. According to them, they are setting an apostolic example for us by their filthiness, ignorance, bawdiness, and insolence. Moreover, it is amusing to find that they insist that everything be done in fastidious detail, as if employing the orderliness of mathematics, a small mistake in which would be a great crime. Just so many knots must be on each shoelace, and each shoelace of one specified color. Just so much lace is allowed on each habit. The girdle must be of just the right material and width, the hood of a certain shape and capacity, their hair of just so many fingers' length. And finally, they can sleep only the specified number of hours per day. Can they not understand, because of a variety of bodies and temperaments, all this equality and restriction is in fact very unequal? Good for him. See, he's way ahead of his time criticizing their stupid system, and people can see that he's right. Nevertheless, because of all this detail that they employ, they think they are superior to all other people. And what is more, amid all their pretense of apostolic charity, the members of one order denounce the members of another order clamorously because of the way in which the habit has been belted or the slightly darker color of it. You will find some among the monks who are so strictly religious and pious, they will wear no outer clothes other than those made of Cilician goat's hair, or inner garments other than the ones made of Milesian wool. Some others, however, will permit linen outer garments, but they again insist on wool underneath. Members of other orders shrink from the mere touch of money as if it were poison. They do not, however, retreat from the touch of wine or women. All derive a great deal of joy in choosing the name of their order, as if it were not enough to be called Christians. In short, all the different orders make sure that nothing in their lives will be uniform, nor is it so much their concern to be like Christ as it is to be unlike one another. You know, they're little cliques, and they make sure they're different than the other little clique of monks. Many of them work so hard at protocol and traditional fastidiousness, that they think one heaven hardly suitable a reward for their labors, never recalling, however, that the time will come when Christ will demand a reckoning of all that he has prescribed, namely love, and he will hold their deeds of little account. One monk will then exhibit his belly, filled with every kind of fish. Another will profess a knowledge of over 100 hymns. Still another will reveal a countless number of fasts he has made, and will account for his large belly by explaining that his fasts have always been broken by a large single meal. Another will show a list of church ceremonies over which he has officiated, so large that it would fill 7 ships. While another will brag that he hasn't touched money in over 60 years unless he wore 2 pairs of gloves to protect his fingers. Another will take pride in the fact that he has lived a beggarly life, as exemplified by how filthy and dirty his hood is, which even a sailor would not see fit to wear. Another will take glory in the fact that he has parasitically lived in the same spot for over 55 years. Another will exhibit his hoarse voice, which is a result of his diligent chanting. Another, a lethargy contracted from his reclusive living. Still another, muteness as a result of his vow of silence. But to Christ, interrupting their otherwise unending pleas, will ask himself, "Where does this new race of Jews come from? I recognize only one commandment that is truly mine, and yet I hear nothing of it." See, he's comparing it to the Jews in the Old Testament, the Pharisees that kept all those laws, and yet their hearts were from God. I know of one notable fool, scholar, who is ready to expound the mystery of the Holy Trinity to a distinguished assembly. Wishing to exhibit exceptional scholarship and please the divine in a special way, he embarked upon his lecture in an unheard-of manner. That is, he began by showing the relation of letters, syllables, and words. From there he explained the agreement between nouns and verbs and nouns and adjectives. At once everyone became lost in amazement at this new approach and began to ask among themselves the question Horace once asked, quote, "What is all this stink about?" As his oration progressed, however, he drew out this observation. that through the foregoing elements of grammar, he could demonstrate the Holy Trinity so clearly, no mathematician could demonstrate it more understandably through his use of symbols in the sand. This fastidious monk had worked so hard on this one sermon, for the previous 8 months he became blind as a mole, all the keenness of his sight having given way to the sharpness of his mind. This man, to this day, however, does not regret the loss of his sight to any degree because he believes it was small price indeed to pay for so much glory. I know of another monk of 80 years of age who was so scholarly, it was often said Scotus himself was reborn in him. He expounded the mystery of the name of Jesus, showing with admirable subtlety that the letters of the name served to explain all that could be understood about Jesus. The fact that the name can be declined in three different cases, Jesus, Jesum, Jesu, clearly illustrates the threefold nature of God. In the one case, the name ends with S, showing he is the sum. In the second, it ends with M, demonstrating he is the middle. Finally, in the third case, we see the ending U, this symbolizing that he is the ultimate. He amazed his audience even more when he treated the letters of the name mathematically. The name Jesus was equally divided into two parts with an S left in the middle. He then proceeded to point out that this lone letter was sin in the Hebrew language, pronounced sin, and furthermore, this Hebrew letter was a word in the Scottish dialect, which means peccatum, Latin for sin. From the above premises, he declared to his audience, this connection shows Jesus Christ takes away the sins of the world. His listeners, especially the theologians, were so amazed at this new approach that some of them came near to be overtaken with the same mysterious force that transformed Niobe to stone. As for my reaction, I was more inclined to imitate shoddy Priapus, who upon witnessing the nocturnal rites of Candida and Segona, fled from the spot. They reach the height of their theological and rhetorical ability, and they astound their audiences by flowering their speech when referring to each other. They call each other illustrious titles, such as renowned doctor, subtle doctor, very subtle doctor, seraphic doctor, holy doctor, invincible doctor. Next, they mystify their uneducated audience by their use of syllogisms, majors, minors, conclusions, corollaries, conversions, and other scholarly devices, playing upon the ignorance of the crowd. Our popes, cardinals, and bishops have for a long while now diligently followed the example of the state and the practices of the princes, and have come near to beating these noblemen at their own game. If our bishops would stop and consider what their white alps signify, namely sincerity and a pure life, what is signified by their two-horned mitre, the peaks of which are joined by a common knot, a perfect knowledge and understanding of the Old New Testament, and what is meant by their wearing of gloves, immaculate administration of the sacraments, untainted by any selfishness, and what their crozier symbolizes, their diligent and protective watch of the flock they are charged with, and what is signified by the cross carried before them in processions, the victory of spiritual charity over carnal affections, if they would but contemplate these and other virtues, I'm sure it would be safe to say they would not lead such troubled, shameful lives. But as it is, they are kept too busy feeding themselves to think on these things. As for the care of their sheep, they delegate this duty to one of their subordinates, or to Christ himself. Nor have they stopped to contemplate the title they bear, or to examine its meaning. Bishop, meaning labor, or diligent, or solicitude. Yet when it comes to pecuniary matters, this is money matters, they truly act the part of a bishop to the hilt, overseeing everything and overlooking nothing. In a similar matter, the cardinals would stop. Let's see, I'll just skip down through this. Then he talks about the popes and the type of lifestyle they live and how rich they are. Let's see. There's a section I wanted to read you. He's talking about the monks again here. He says, "You can imagine how much pleasure they derive from shaping and reshaping the Holy Scriptures as if they were made of wax. And they insist that their own conclusions, subscribed to by only a few students, are more valid than Solon's laws and preferred before a pope's decrees. They are world censors. Good for you. See, they're censoring like a censor for the whole world. They set themselves up as a judge for the whole world. Furthermore, they draw exact pictures of every part of hell, as though they had spent many years there. They also fabricate new heavenly regions, as imagination dictates, adding the biggest of all and the finest there for themselves. They walk there, entertain at dinner there, even play a game of ball there. Their heads are so stuffed and stretched with these and 2,000 other trivialities of the same sort, I am certain Jupiter's brain was no more pregnant when he yelled for Vulcan's help to bring forth Pallas. Therefore, do not be astonished when you see a monk's head all wrapped up in swathes at a public debate, for if it wasn't, it would explode into pieces. I derive much pleasure myself when these theologians, holding themselves in such great esteem, begin to speak in their slovenly, barbarous tongues and jabber so no one except another jabberer can understand them. When they reach the highest pitch, which they call highest acumen, no common man can attain this. It is their claim that it is beyond the station of sacred discourse to be obliged to adhere to the rules of grammarians. What an amazing attribute. Only theologians are allowed incorrect speech. As a matter of fact, they share this honor with most intellectuals. When they are addressed as our masters, they feel they're in proximity to the gods. They feel that the term has the same religious vigor as the unspeakable four letters of the name of God. Anyway, I think you get the idea. It goes on page after page after page after page after page. Hundreds of pages of talking about what they do, and it makes fun of them. And people love this man, Erasmus, because of his wit and his knowledge and his saintliness. He's a Roman Catholic who helped the Reformation.
Could you read a short excerpt on the Pope?
Well, let me do this first, and if I have time, I will, okay? What I want to do is summarize the information on your test from 590 to 1517. This is the age known as the Thyatira Church Age, or the Medieval Church, characterized by five movements: papal authority, monasticism, Islam, the Crusades, and the pre-Reformation period, consisting of certain men and certain movements. The fall of the Roman Empire in 476 opened the way for the papacy to begin its rise to temporal power. We also have Islam, important in church history because it almost overran the entire world, including the church in Europe. Muhammad was born in AD 570, and the movement ended at the Battle of Tours. That's significant because it freed Western Europe from the threat of Islam. Charles Martel led the Christian forces in the Battle of Tours, which occurred in France in 732. Monasticism is an ascetic system of religion involving monks and nuns. The Holy Roman Empire was the territory of Western Europe, basically Germany and Italy, ruled by German kings. And the Holy Roman Empire is usually dated 962 to 1806. The Habsburgs were the royal European family who held the throne of the Holy Roman Empire for centuries. Charlemagne was king of the Franks, who established an alliance between his empire and the Roman Catholic Church, and was the first Germanic ruler to be crowned emperor by the Pope. He lived 742 to 814. The Crusades were European military expeditions to regain the Holy Land from Muslim control. Gregory I is generally recognized as the first real pope, and his papacy began a new period of church history in AD 590. Pope Leo III helped bring the papacy to world power by crowning Charlemagne, thus uniting the church and the empire. Nicholas I was the first pope to wear a civil crown. The false decretals, or pseudo-Isidorian decretals, are a collection of canons and papal letters containing many forgeries, but used deliberately by Pope Nicholas to gain temporal power. The Council of Constantinople IV was held in AD 869. To solve the iconoclastic controversy. This is the conflict over whether images should be venerated or not, which raged in the Eastern Church. At this council, the excommunication of Photius, Patriarch of Constantinople, was ratified, thus splitting the Eastern Church from the Western Church. This is known as the Great Schism, that is, the division of Christendom into Eastern and Western churches. Nicholas I initiated the Great Schism. It's traditionally dated AD 1054, though. The blackest chapter of the church, known today as the midnight hour of the papacy, occurred in the 9th to 11th centuries. The rule of the harlots occurred during this time. It was a period when the papacy was occupied by adulterers and the illegitimate sons of papal mistresses. This happened in the 10th century. Benedict IX is regarded as the worst pope. He took office at age 12. He's probably the worst character among all of the popes. The conciliar movement was a movement among Catholic prelates who attempted to make the pope subject to the decisions of a general council. Gregory VII led the papacy out of corruption to its golden age of papal power. Innocent III was pope at the summit of papal power. The Inquisition was a Roman Catholic tribunal directed at the suppression of heresy, which martyred many true believers, and the Inquisition took place in the 13th to 16th century. Then there's the Spanish Inquisition under Thomas de Torquemada, the chief inquisitor in Spain. Innocent III deepened the rift between the Roman Catholic and Greek Orthodox churches when he overthrew Constantinople, and also the brutal treatment of the city by his armies embittered the East. Shortly after 1213, when King John of England signed Great Britain over to the papacy forever, English nobles discovered the old Magna Carta and were incited to declare freedom, causing civil war in England. In other words, they didn't obey the law that England would be Catholic forever. In the 200 years following Innocent III, the papacy declined drastically in power. Boniface VIII's famous bull, Unum Sanctum, says there is no salvation or remission of sins outside the Roman Catholic Church. That's traditionally dated 1302. Outside of that, we just have a few points on certain things, like characteristics of monasticism, which are asceticism, celibacy, chastity, obedience, poverty, solitude, and vows. Religious orders found within monasticism: Augustinian, Benedictine, Carmelite, Cistercian, Dominican, Franciscan, and Jesuit, and the mendicants, although the mendicant is not the name of an order. A mendicant just means a beggar, and a Franciscan can be a mendicant, or a Carmelite can be a mendicant, and so forth. And then we had the pre-Reformation characters like Henry of Lausanne, Jerome of Prague, Sir John Oldcastle, and some of the others that we studied. Let's see, who else did we study? We studied Peter de Bray, Erasmus, John Huss, Savonarola, Peter Waldo, John Wycliffe, and let's see. That's all I have to say. That's the material on your test. Okay. Any questions? Let me see. This would be kind of complicated to do.
Well, we have to know the
popes. No. Let's see. The only pope you'll need to know Gregory the First, who worked hard during the 6th century to stabilize the church and purify it. That's Hildebrand, or Gregory the First. Excuse me, that's not Hildebrand. That's Gregory the first pope. And then Gregory the Seventh, that's Hildebrand. He worked hard in the 11th century to purify the church, oppose simony and immorality, and bring the papacy to world power. And under the threat of losing his kingdom, the Holy Roman Emperor, Henry IV, came to this pope, Gregory, for penance and was forced to wait 3 days in the snow. Do you remember that? That's Gregory VII. So you have Gregory I, and then Gregory VII, and then Innocent. Those are the only three popes I'm requiring you to know. Innocent brought the state under complete domination by the church, ruling practically all the monarchs of the West and the East. He decreed transubstantiation, confession, and his own infallibility, ordered 2 crusades, condemned the Magna Carta, called the 12th General Council, ordered the extermination of heretics, massacred the Albigenses, and offered the crown of King John of England to King Philip of France. Okay, then you just need to know a little bit about each one of those men that we talked about in the pre-Reformation movements. Okay, let me go back and read just a little bit more of Erasmus. It now pleases me to expound about kings. If these men had any wisdom at all, they would see their lives are as cheerless and undesirable as the lives of the clergymen. For let anyone reflect upon how much responsibility would rest on his shoulders if he were to be a righteous king, and he will conclude that it is not worth perjuring himself or poisoning someone else to become one. He will see that on becoming a sovereign, he would no longer have any time to spend on his private affairs. The fact is, kings, with my advice, leave all these matters to the gods and occupy themselves with one thing, living extravagantly, while granting audiences only to those people who wish to approach them on pleasant matters. For these sovereigns cannot afford to let fears get a hold on them. They believe that to play the part of a monarch to the hilt is to hunt diligently, raise fine horses, sell high offices so as to realize a profit, and fashion new schemes of draining the wealth of the citizens into their own pockets. All of these schemes are carried out in due form, under various official titles, so that even though unjust, they will seem to have some appearance of justness. They also make sure that these schemes are applied appealingly, so they can secure not only the wealth, but also the hearts of their subjects. See, he's saying, they spend all their time just living extravagantly. And anybody has any bad news, they delegate that off to other people, and they only receive visitors if they want to talk about something good. They spend all their time devising ways to get richer. Now, what shall I say about the noble courtiers? These men desire to be likened as God's foremost creatures. Yet the fact is, no group of men is more sordid, obsequious, idiotic, or contemptible than them. One point in which they are as unaspiring as one could be is that while they are happy to wear gold, jewels, and scarlet on their bodies, they leave to others virtue and wisdom that accompany these symbols. These men are accustomed to sleeping till noon every day, at which time a hired priest comes to their bedside and quickly runs through the morning prayers before they awaken. After they awaken, they set in on their breakfast, which is no sooner finished than dinner is served. After dinner, they proceed to amuse themselves with dice games, checkers, cards, clowns, fools, whores, and general horseplay and nonsense, scattered throughout which is a round or two of drinks. Next comes supper, after which is not only one, but many toasts. In this way, their hours, days, months, years, and lives are dwindled away. As for myself, I enjoy watching their extravagant lives almost as much as eating a good meal, observing how every one of the ladies thinks her closeness to the gods is measured by the length of her train on her dress, how the noblemen pass one another in order to stand the closest to Jove, and how each of the nobles is exalted in wearing a heavier chain around his neck, as if they were demonstrating their strength instead of their wealth. He means the thicker the gold is on the chain, the richer you are. Our popes, cardinals, and bishops have for a long while now diligently followed the example of the state. Let's see, I think I already read part of that. In a similar manner, the cardinals, if the cardinals would stop and consider the fact of their succession of the apostles, they would realize the same good deeds are expected of them. It would do them a great deal of good also to consider the significance of their vestments and to ask themselves these questions. Does not the whiteness of the upper garment symbolize purity and stainlessness of heart? Now you can see he's still a Catholic here. That's why I'm reading this part. He's got this idea. Well, he's not opposed to the garments. You know, he's just saying the white represents stainlessness of heart. So how come you're corrupt at heart? Is not the scarlet or crimson of the lower garments an emblem of burning love and desire for God? What is the significance of the outer robe? Does not its abundant folds serve another purpose than just cover this mule? Is it not a symbol of charity sufficient enough to receive all men by its helpfulness? And finally, what need I do, a needy apostle, have for all this ill-gotten money? It is my belief that if they would stop and consider these questions, then they would not clamor after the bishopric. Or if they did get the office, they would lead a weary and pious life, like the kind lived by the ancient apostles. As to the supreme pontiffs, if they would recall that they take the place of Christ and would attempt to imitate his poverty, task, doctrines, crosses, and disregard of safety, if they were even to contemplate the meaning of the name Pope, that is, Father, or of the title of Most Holy, then they would become the most humble and mortified of all men. How many, then, would be willing to spend all their wealth and efforts in order to procure this position? If someone were foolish enough to procure it in this manner, would they further be willing to defend their position by the shedding of blood, by the use of poison, or by any other necessary means? Oh, how wisdom would upset their nefarious plans if it were to inflict them. Wisdom, did I say? Nay, even a grain of salt, that salt spoken of by Christ, would be sufficient to upset their plans. It would lose them all their wealth, their honor, their belongings, their powers won by victories, their offices, dispensations, tributes, and indulgences. They would lose a great many horses, a great many mules, a great many carts, and finally they would lose a great many pleasures. See how I have comprehended in a few words many markets full of a great harvest, a wide ocean of goods. These forfeitures would be replaced by vigils, fasts, sorrows, prayers, sermons, education, weariness, and a thousand other bothersome tasks of the sort. We should also mention that a great many copyists, notaries, lobbyists, promoters, secretaries, muleteers, grooms, bankers, and pimps, I was about to add something more tender, though rougher on the ears, I am afraid, these people would be out of jobs. In other words, that a large group of men that burdens, I beg your pardon, I mean to say adorns the Holy Roman Pope, would be done away with and would have to, as a result, resort to begging as a means of making a living. Those who are even worse, those very princes of the church and guiding lights of the world, would become nothing more than a staff and a wallet. See, he's saying, if they really followed Christ, they wouldn't live that way. Those who are even worse... Let's see. However, this action would be barbarous and abhorred. Under the present system, what work need be done is handed over to Peter or Paul to do at their leisure, while pomp and pleasure are personally taken care of by the popes. They don't want to work. They have the other guy do the work, and then they just live in pleasure. They believe themselves to be readily acceptable by Christ with a mystical, almost theatrical finery. Thus, they proceed with pomp with such titles as Beatitude, Reverence, and Holiness, between blessings and cursings, to execute the role of a bishop. Miracles are considered to be antiquated and old-fashioned. To educate people is irritating. To pray is a waste of time. To interpret the scripture is a mere formality. To weep is distressing and womenish. To live in poverty, ignominious. To be beaten in war is dishonorable and not worthy of one who insists that kings, no matter how great, bend and kiss his sacred foot. And to die is unpleasant. Death on the cross would be dishonor. See, he's showing how unlike Christ they are. The only remaining powers invested with the pontiffs are the sacred benedictions of which Paul speaks. The popes are certainly liberal enough with these interdictions, excommunications, re-excommunications, anathemas, edicts, vivaciously depicting damnation and the terrific lightning bolt of the bull, which by merely flickering submerges the souls of men below the floor of hell. And these powers are launched against no one with more vigor than against those who under the devil's tutorship dispute and deny the authority of Peter's throne. Although Peter has been recorded as saying in the gospel, "We have left all and follow thee," the popes of our time insist on profanely attaching Peter's name to territories, cities, taxes, wages, and all money. So, I think you get the flavor of the writing here. He's really a good writer. Okay, when we come back, we'll take the test on this period of history, then we'll start studying the Reformation. Thanks. Make sure I have all of your papers, Catholic terms papers. Hi, Patricia, thanks.